Welcome to Awesome Movie Year, the podcast where we take a look back at an awesome year for movies, which is every year. My name is Josh Bell, film critic and writer, and I am joined by my co-host.
I'm Jason Harris, filmmaker, comedian, and hey...
Jason doing a sadly accurate impression of the stars of this film that we're about to talk about.
Too bad we don't have video for that one, but I thought, you know, what really encapsulates this movie? Yeah. It's
Ghost?
There was no banana peel to slip on, but otherwise I think the facials were pretty accurate on that one. So,
you know. Yeah, so in this season of Awesome Movie Year, we've been talking about the films of 1939. And we are here at our producer David Rosen's pick. And Dave, what did you subject us to?
Oh boy, I picked a movie called The Gorilla.
And why did you do that?
You know what? I got to say, like right off the bat, I had no idea what this movie was going to be. I just saw a guy in a gorilla costume, and I don't know a lot of movies from this era. And something about it spoke to me. I didn't even know it was going to be this like comedy trio thing where they're, you know, investigating. Like, I didn't really get the synopsis just based off the one sentence in the poster. And I'm so glad I picked it, though. I love this movie. It's so stupid.
Yeah. See, Josh, Dave and I were taking some chances on our picks, and we get an all-time Howard Hawks classic and a gorilla mishap movie. So I feel like we've owned this season pretty well, two of us.
Yeah. Yeah, Dave sees a guy in a gorilla suit, and that's all he needs.
It spoke to him. It spoke to him.
Yep.
Deeply, something deep inside. Yeah, so The Gorilla, not one of the all-time classics, as many of the movies we've talked about this season have been, but sort of a, I don't know if we could call this a cult movie. I think maybe when we were initially discussing the lineup for this season, I did have this as a possibility for our cult episode. So there are some other weirdos like Dave who are into this,
I'm sure.
Well, it might not be a cult classic, but it does have a cult following of famous comedians. I have read a lot of quotes from different comedians about how the Ritz brothers inspired them.
Yeah.
But is it that they like this movie or they like the Ritz brothers and in particular the Ritz brothers live performances?
And in particular, Harry Ritz. Norman Lear said Harry Ritz was as funny as any human being in or out of comedy I have ever met. He was a jewel in a glorious setting and his brothers were that setting.
Yeah, I mean, I think you don't get that. At least I didn't from watching this film. The Ritz brothers, Harry, Al, and Jimmy are the stars of this film, and they are sort of like the discount Marx Brothers, I guess we could say.
Yeah, Marx Brothers light, I think, is fair.
So, yeah.
You know.
And they were big stars on stage, and I think they made many efforts to translate that into film stardom, and it didn't really take, it seems like.
They made 7 or 8 movies, and I think there were some things where, like, studio heads wanted Harry to go out on his own, and they got into bad contracts, but it didn't really matter because they were so successful on stage. This was just like, hey, man, yeah, let's go for it. Kind of like, you know, it's akin to Carrot Top and Chairman of the Board, Josh.
I was going to go with Larry the Cable Guy Health Inspector, but that is a good example.
Not Operation Delta Force or whatever that one was.
Delta Farce. Farce, Jason.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It is similar like that when you take these comedy performers that have a specific style in their stage performances and an audience that likes them, and you try to sort of cram them into some unrelated movie. And that is what this is, and it's interesting because there are sort of two independently popular things that are colliding here, right? You've got the Ritz brothers who have their whole following and are trying to break in to become movie stars. And then you have The Gorilla, which was this play by Ralph Spence that was sort of a parody of spooky dark house horror movies that had already been adapted twice into other movies, or sorry, 3 times. This is the 4th adaptation of this play. Wow. It was initially adapted in 1927 and in 1930. Both of those movies now, unfortunately, or maybe not unfortunately, are lost. And in 1937, it was switched up. The animal of the title was switched up, and it was adapted into the movie Shh, the Octopus, which
Josh watched it.
I watched it. It's something. You think this movie is weird, man? The octopus movie is even weirder.
It's such a strange idea to be like, well, if we just switch the animal around, we can redo that. I can understand that, but to choose an octopus, which is not an animal that can just move around a living room and a mansion freely, is a very strange idea.
You think that, but well, first of all, they changed the setting. Instead of a spooky mansion, it's a spooky lighthouse. So it has like a whole underground area where the octopus can be in the water. But, you know, just as we have the gorilla arm reaching out of secret passages in this film, the octopus arms reach out of secret passages in that film.
Josh, now that you've mentioned this, I feel Robert Eggers really missed an opportunity with the lighthouse.
I mean, I will say, Dave, that whenever you did your episode of Piecing It Together on the Lighthouse, you need to go back and amend it and add the octopus, because it's definitely a puzzle piece for it. Yeah, and it has a lot of that, but there's only two. The play, I guess, only has two detective characters, and they had to add a third one for the Ritz brothers. But the ones in the octopus movie are slightly less annoying.
But Josh, you know, when preparing for this season, I watched Bringing Up Baby, 1938, all-time classic. And that has the old switcheroo with like the leopard or the cheetah also, right? Where there's like two different animals. And so this seems to be a popular plot device of the time.
Animal mix-ups, really a whole thing here in the 1930s, in the comedy of the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So the play also, I mean, the reason it was adapted into all those movies is because it was a big success. It opened in April 1925 on Broadway and ran for 257 performances. So something about this spoke to the people of the time.
I wish we could combine your pick and Dave's pick, and we could have had a play where the women keep confusing gorillas. with each other? I don't know.
So. As long as it's a female gorilla, right? That's
there you go. Yeah. Who has to stand up to her cheating mate.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So this movie, I couldn't find, you know, as often has been the case this season, there were not specific box office figures for this. It did have a budget of $175,000. And one of the financial issues with this film is that the Ritz brothers didn't want to do it, and they had to be sued in order to force them to honor their contract. So you know that a movie in which the stars are contractually obligated to be there, and that's the only reason they made it, that's always a sign of quality, right?
Well, as you know, not just that, Josh, the part of the reason the filming was postponed was because the Ritz brothers' father died. And of course, the studios, being benevolent as they were, and often still are, were like, hey, you got to do this movie. And if you don't, we're going to sue you.
Well, right. Yes. But I mean, I was looking even at some newspaper clippings from this time, and it wasn't just that. Like, they also, not that they weren't bereaved, but it seemed like they were kind of also capitalizing on that because they didn't want to do this sort of B-level spooky haunted mansion picture.
Good for them.
Yeah, I guess so. But they're, you know, I think they're, if they thought they were above this material, they're not.
Jerry Lewis said Harry was the teacher. He had the extraordinary ability to deny himself dignity on stage. Harry taught us that the only thing that mattered was getting a laugh, whether you did it with a camel or with two rabbis humping a roadmap. Harry spawned us all. We all begged, borrowed, and stole from him, every one of us. Without him, we wouldn't be here.
I mean, if there's some documentation of the brilliance of the Ritz brothers, it's not here.
I mean, look, we can get into that, but Harry Ritz definitely has, you know, charisma and comic timing, and he probably could have broken out. And I mean, you know, like you said, Josh, they didn't want to do this movie. The material is not the best either, right?
Oh, absolutely. Agreed. But I will say, I could not tell you the difference between Harry Ritz and the other Ritz brothers.
No, Harry
watched this film.
Harry Ritz was the one who talked and did stuff. And the other ones were the guys who were behind him.
But they also talked and they also did stuff.
Yeah.
They also all talked in the same way and did stuff in the same way. That's, I think, that to me is the big thing. like the Marx Brothers or the Three Stooges or Laurel and Hardy or any of these big old-timey comedy people, whether you like them or not, they have like distinctive personalities. The point of the teams is that they have like contrasting styles or whatever. The Ritz Brothers are just three of the same guy.
It's Harry and I think the other two behind him. But Dave,
Harry and also Harry and also also Harry.
Dave, you watched the three Musketeers with Dom Amici and the Ritz Brothers, which is regarded as their best movie. Did you have more of a sense of individuals in that one?
Not really. It's still three heads, just all, you know, bumping into each other, funnily.
And Dave is a fan of the Ritz Brothers. So yeah. That's what he says.
Yeah.
So critics were mixed, but more positive about this than I would have expected, actually.
Yes. I wonder how Josh feels about this movie, Dave. I can't really tell so far.
Yeah, I know.
You know, Jason, I think you agree with me about this movie. So, you know.
Yeah, I didn't love it. When we get to the end, when we can talk about it, it just careens off a cliff. And I'm like, huh, that was the structure of the play that was so successful. So
the New York Times, in a review that I'm sure did have a byline once, but didn't by the time it got to the website. So somebody in the New York Times said, 20th Century Fox has not, we regretfully report, enhanced the standing of the comic muse, nor has it contributed much to the enjoyment of patrons this week through its comedy treatment of the ancient Ralph Spence chiller tersely titled The Gorilla. The Ritz Brothers, Harry, Jimmy, and Al, are there to supply a note of hilarity to the supposedly eerie proceedings, but even their antic buffoonery is not equal to the task. The real comedian of the show, strangely enough, is a gentleman named Art Miles. He's the gorilla, who pops up every so often emitting strange noises and thumping his hairy chest, courtesy of the prop department, in the best Tarzan tradition. It's all supposed to be either very funny or shockingly thrilling, depending how you look at it. We couldn't see it either way.
I mean, Art Miles did the job, but I don't put him in the Andy Serkis you know, kind of category.
What if
of like
we remade this movie starring motion capture Andy Serkis?
Okay, and now who are our Ritz Brothers in this remake, Josh?
Three motion capture Andy Serkises as the Ritz Brothers.
No, there's got to be like, you know, the Lawrence Brothers. That's a horrible example.
Brother, that's your.
I'm trying to think of like famous siblings who could do this at this point in time.
Well, I feel like maybe it would be going back to our example of like hack comedians like shoehorned into movies. It would be a team up of like Carrot Top and Larry the Cable Guy and Yahoo Serious.
No, I'm going, they have to be related. Like Logan and Jake Paul could be the stars of it.
That seems likely. That seems more likely.
I don't know. Are there any famous siblings left?
Yeah, but I mean, they
Casey
are.
Casey and Ben Affleck in The Gorilla. Yeah,
right. The Skarsgards.
Right, yeah. There's like 10 of them.
The Hemsworths.
Yeah, there
right.
You go.
Yeah, that's perfect. So then weirdly, other critics thought this was really enjoyable somehow. Mary Harris in the Washington Post said,
no relation.
No, you would definitely disavow that. A gorilla with a murder complex, plus an old Victorian manse full of secret passages, plus people who disappear every time the lights are turned out. It adds up to fever and chills. But toss in the Ritz Brothers and the arithmetic changes. The worse the catastrophe, the bigger the laugh. So the gorilla is a goulash of shivers and giggles. It should be a mop-up at the neighborhood theaters. It has more excitement than a Western, and all the laughs usually lacking in the Haas operas. It'll amuse the grown folks and give the kids the time of their lives.
What is a Haas opera?
It's a horse opera, but she just said Haas, you know, because she's hip with the lingo.
Well, I've never heard horses sing opera. That sounds amazing to me.
we already had a discussion of the term horse opera in a previous episode.
Yeah, but I just ritzed you, bro.
Hell yeah, you did. That's a new word now that you've coined there.
So this is the second review you've read where they're like, there are spine tingling turns and, you know, twists of terror. And I'm like, this is a straight comedy all the way through. There is nothing. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But like anyone who's like trying to add a element of horror or thriller, it's not there.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as far as I can discern from reading about the play, it is also a comedy. It's meant to be a parody of these kinds of horror stories.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge farce, right? So right. That, like, I don't know why we're not on that wavelength.
Yeah, this movie, I don't know what it does to people. So,
Dave, I'm getting great enjoyment out of Josh's misery, right?
Yeah.
So finally, JRR in the Seattle Daily Times.
No relation.
Yeah. he said, all of the favorite old stock mystery devices and many new ones, combined with the half-wit comedy of the Ritz brothers, make the farcical new spine tingler, The Gorilla, good screen fare for lovers of both nonsense and fright. The Gorilla is a modernized version of that well-remembered old stage hit by Ralph Spence, which made a name for itself a few years ago as the first to be balanced precariously on the borderline between terror and farce. Once the harebrained Ritzes, private detectives extraordinary, take the case in hand and start chasing the monster through dark corridors, the hearty laughs come as often as the shocks.
Well, Josh, here's a quote from you from H.M. Moneybags in the Philadelphia. These Ritzes go crackers for the ape. Ritz!
I wonder if, like, the play was the... I think we talked about this, I can't remember when, but about the invention of, like, action comedy. And maybe Ralph Spence invented the horror comedy, and that's why people are so amazed by this.
Yeah. I just don't see anything, you know, there's no horror to it, but that's okay, you know.
Yeah. Dave, did you have a thought on that?
Well, I mean, it is a spooky setting. It, like you said, it's a spoof Fair. Of these kinds of things, but it's not scary at all, like 0%. So, like, it's weird.
I also want to jump in on that because, you know, so I watched for an upcoming episode, we're doing Son of Frankenstein, and I watched the 1931 Frankenstein, you know. And I was thinking, like, wow, it must have been shocking. Like, when we see that monster, right? Like, it's like, oh, cool, we know who Frankenstein is, right? But when they saw the monster on screen for the first time, it must have been shocking and terrifying. And I wonder if this performance by the gorilla, like, you know, where they had never necessarily seen a giant gorilla other than King Kong. Never mind.
Right, I was going to say, so. King Kong came out like 7 years before this.
So, I was trying, guys. I was trying to give it something here to back Dave up.
But... You were reaching like the gorilla reaching through the window.
Right. Yeah. They'd never seen an arm in a like furry sleeve reach out of a door before.
Well, I was trying.
Yes,
I was wrong, but I was trying.
We appreciate it. So, Dave, you had not seen this. Had you even heard of the Ritz brothers before?
No, which is crazy because, like Jason was saying, like a lot of comedians loved them. I read that Mel Brooks, they were his favorite comedy troupe. Like,
Mel Brooks, as far as I'm concerned, Harry Ritz was the funniest man ever. His craziness and his freedom were unmatched. There was no intellectualizing with him. You just hoped that there were no pointy objects in the room when he was working because you were down on the floor, spitting out of control, laughing your brains out. Harry Ritz always put me away, always.
Amazing. I mean, I feel like we've entered into an alternate dimension where the Ritz brothers are these like icons that... We none of us ever even heard of them.
I'm so glad I picked this movie.
Yeah, Josh is just upset that all these famous comedians are putting on the Ritz. You got Ritz three times.
I mean, do you think that that's the reason that Mel Brooks included that song in
Oh my
Young
God.
Frankenstein?
Wow. Oh,
interesting. Now we're good. Between that and Son and Frankenstein, we've really pieced together Young Frankenstein. Mm.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Jason, right, you'd never seen this. You're like a comedy history connoisseur. Had you heard of the Ritz brothers?
No, my dad knew of them. You know, my grandfather was a comedian for 66 years, and obviously you know, he was born as, I think vaudeville was kind of ending, but you know, I always knew somewhat about that history, and you could see this type of act being a huge sensation in that type of you know, performance era.
I just wonder, do they do something different in their stage act that all of these people find?
I think they play music too, don't they?
Yeah, but that's not like, it's not like Weird Al comedy music, right?
I mean, they have a really funny song in that Three Musketeers movie. So, yeah. I mean,
well, maybe it is. Maybe they're precursors of Weird Al also.
But a lot of it is, you know, that kind of fast double talk, like misinterpreting. And that was a very popular style of comedy at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, it didn't reach me. So, and obviously didn't really reach movie audiences as they kept trying to make them stars and failing. So,
I don't know about that. I mean, if they failed so hard, I don't think they would have made 8 movies or 7 movies, Josh.
I mean, they made super low. Like, how many movies did Larry the Cable Guy make?
3. Well, I mean, he was in Cars.
Right.
He made a lot of money in Cars.
That's true. But in terms of like starring vehicles for him, there are quite a few, actually. Unfortunately.
Well, that's because he gets her done, Josh.
He does. He does indeed. So anything else you want to say about the background of this film, Jason?
Shimmy Moggles!
All right, we'll come back and talk more of our general thoughts on the gorilla. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1939, we are talking about our producer David Rosen's pick, The Gorilla. And Dave, you said you didn't really know anything about this movie when you picked it, but it turned out to be perfect for you. So what did you like about it?
The dumb, silly comedy that we're making fun of here, like, I loved it. I thought it landed so hard. The very first time we see the Rich Brothers and they're sitting in that car parked outside of the mansion and the lightning and thunder crashes and they drop the umbrella inside of the car on their heads. Like, I was in already. I was like, this movie's for me. Actually, even go further back than that, the opening newspaper headlines, I was already done. Like, that was, you know, over the credits. But yeah, it's just such a dumb comedy, but I really got it, you know, it just fit right on my wavelength of like some of the dumbest stuff I like. And there were so many funny moments. I loved all the side characters. I loved the parody of it. You know, I love how well it kind of captures those old horror movies and kind of plays with them. And, you know, I get, obviously, if you don't find it funny, you know, none of this is going to work at all. So it makes total sense why you wouldn't like it, Josh. But I was laughing beginning to end, and so I appreciated everything else about it, too.
I feel like the missed opportunity was all three of us watching together, because I could have seen Dave laugh and Josh descend deeper into his pit of despair, and that would have really upped my enjoyment on this thing.
I mean, I've seen way worse movies, and at least this is like 66 minutes long. It was
That's nice.
That's what, yeah, unlike The Women, which is 16 hours long, this is a way better pick.
And I was watching The Women and laughing the entire time. You know, that comedy just, you know, I found incredibly entertaining. So, yeah, you know, Dave, the thing, though, is like I've seen a lot of these old dark house, including the old dark house, the like, sort of, you know, origin of a lot of this stuff, a lot of these old horror movies. And I just didn't think it was an effective parody. They're not really cleverly subverting the tropes of these films per se. They're just like, what if these goofy dumbasses were in one of those movies? And like, it's like when they insert Scooby-Doo into The Wizard of Oz.
That's what I was gonna say. It reminded me of Scooby-Doo, and I love Scooby-Doo.
He's got all some right. work to do now.
Yeah, I mean, clearly this is, you know, again, going with the puzzle pieces, this is clearly a puzzle piece. And the Ritz brothers in general, right, have to be a big influence on Scooby-Doo.
I would think so, absolutely. But yeah, every time the lights turned off and somebody disappeared and it happens again and again, it's like that thing of beating a joke into the ground, you know, like they just keep going for it. And the gorilla arm coming through. I mean, it's they just keep doing these things.
You got to give Harry Ritz some credit for that rubber face. He was able to emote in many different ways with that face.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if emote is the right word, but I mean, he does make some expressions that are meant to be humorous.
Josh, show us a good Harry Ritz face.
I don't think I can do it. You're doing some great ones. Like you said, you know, this is one episode where the video would be a good one to have because Jason, you know, Jason is a professional comedian and he can do some funny faces.
I might, you know, as we all know, I got some big news. I'm going to be in the Netflix's a joke fest. And I feel like maybe there's I got to do some Ritz style faces in this festival.
I think what you should do to really like get yourself some attention is throw out all your material and just do Ritz Brothers material when you perform next time.
Or I could just do my jokes and then just button every joke with a Ritz Brother face and, you know, pratfall or something like that.
The comedy nerds will love it.
So Jason, I mean, you're mocking my distaste for this film, but I know you didn't particularly care for it either.
I was okay with it. I didn't love it. And then when you get to the third act and they explain what happened, I'm like, Josh just did explained in air quotes. But that explanation is, I don't know if anyone wrote a script for that or they just said say words or something, because none of it made any sense. And it was, it kind of brought the whole thing down. Not that I loved it, but I was okay with it. And then it's like, you know, imagine if you were watching like Murder on the Orient Express, right? And you get to the big explanation and then you're like, what? What did you just say? Why is this the explanation? And it's just a bunch of exposition that doesn't work or make sense or add anything. It only detracts from what you've already seen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and I suppose, you know, you could argue that given that this is a parody of these kinds of films, the idea that there's this incredibly convoluted explanation for what's going on that actually makes no sense, maybe is intentional as a joke, but it doesn't come off that way. You know, I do think that despite what we're saying, that this movie is not scary and like not even meant to be scary per se, I think the horror or mystery elements of it are meant to have some weight, and a lot of the supporting actors are playing it straight. And so I do think you want that explanation to at least be possible to follow, right?
I wanted the explanation. I wanted to follow it. I don't mind, you know, anything can be as heightened as you want. But if you're going to get to that explanation, you have to either go like you're saying, you have to ground it so it actually adds, or you have to go even further out with it. So it's like, okay, well, now we're just in, you know, space world here. And I don't think it did either. It just like tried to give an explanation that was neither funny nor realistic.
Yeah. And I mean, reading about the play, it sounds like the idea in the play is that someone, one of the characters, is writing a play that's like a spooky play, and all the stuff that goes on, it turns out, is just from the events of that play. And that seems like a dumb cop out. And, you know, spoilers for Shh, the Octopus, but in that one, it's just all a fucking dream. You just, one of the dumb detectives wakes up at the end and is like, "What? You were there, NTM, and you were there." And all the crazy characters are just people in this hospital, like a nurse and a doctor and stuff. And that was even more annoying. So
this one, there's two gorillas, a real gorilla and a man in a gorilla costume, right?
Which, mm-hmm. Wait. The man in the gorilla costume is the real gorilla. I mean, it's an actor in it, but there's no... Is there a person in the movie who's in a gorilla costume?
I thought there was a mishap of, like, two gorillas. Am I just bringing up...
No, you're right about that, but I feel like the two gorillas are... One is the real gorilla, which is the actor in a gorilla costume, and the other is just a dude who calls himself the gorilla.
Why is that?
Because it's... I mean, it's like... Why is which? Like, why does the guy call himself the gorilla?
Explain this movie to me, Josh.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying because, okay. Why does a guy call himself a gorilla? He's supposed to be like a criminal mastermind, right? The gorilla. Uh-huh. And so that to me was just like, it's like, why does Batman call himself Batman? It's just like a goofy, like it's meant to be a scary name or whatever, but obviously it isn't. So I could buy that. Criminal mastermind who calls himself the gorilla
and dresses as such.
No, but does when does he dress as a gorilla?
I thought the whole thing was like a miss, you know, like, hey, gorilla guy here, whoopsie doopsie type thing. And
I mean, I guess, well, there's one point where they show the like gorilla hand that had been coming out of the door or whatever, and one of the characters shows that it's just a fake gorilla. Sleeve or whatever. So is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, sure.
So what I was misunderstanding too was like, so yes, you know, you are correct. There is two gorillas. There's the real gorilla And then there is a person who calls himself the gorilla, who may or may not be dressing as a gorilla, or at least wearing a gorilla arm, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So
two fake gorillas.
Right, right, right. Well, yes. So at one point, the real gorilla, right, gets loose and is terrorizing people. It's running around. It's pounding its chest, as that one review mentions.
Right. So there is a real gorilla.
Yes, yes,
that's
yes,
what I'm
yes.
saying.
No, I am agreeing with you. What I was saying is that the person who calls himself the gorilla isn't dressing as a gorilla. He just uses the name the gorilla.
Well, I mean, see, that was a little confusing because, as Dave alluded to, this trend in 1939 of starting with newspapers, which we see a lot in these movies, yeah. right?
I mean, that's where people got their information.
Yeah, gorilla killer on the loose. And then you see that you see that character dressed as a gorilla, like in the next scene going into the woman's bedroom. So I felt like that gorilla kills in the disguise as a gorilla.
Oh, I forgot about that part at the very beginning, because otherwise we just see the arm. And when you get the reveal, the like Scooby-Doo type, it was old Mr. Withers all along or whatever. They just bring out, it's just the sleeve. It's not a whole gorilla costume. It's just an arm.
Yeah, but the gorilla killer in the beginning does dress as a gorilla to hide his identity, right?
I guess, yeah, I forgot about that part.
So you're confusing me. I was right on this one.
What I was going to ask, though, is, okay, so the real gorilla is on the loose, right? And then the gorilla handler shows up, and he's like, where's my gorilla? And and everyone asks him, why are you here, yeah. right?
Yeah.
And he says, oh, well, somebody hired me to bring my gorilla here.
Right.
Like, who and why?
I think it was the gorilla killer to throw them off the scent.
Okay. Further question. Which character in this movie was the gorilla killer?
The gorilla.
Not the real gorilla, though, right?
No, like, the other gorilla.
Like, no, this goes to what you're saying at the end with the explanation. Like, I feel like there were so many mistaken identities that by the time we got to the end, none of the characters were the gorilla.
Well, the old man who owned the mansion was swindling his business, the people who were doing business with him, right? So
But he wasn't. Wasn't there like an extra reveal at the end where he's like, oh no, this was all a setup and I had to pretend to be swindling him?
Right. Something along those lines. And that's why he brought in, and then the other guy brought in the gorilla to murder him because he was taking the money. I don't know. Dave, explain the movie to me.
Well, to all this, the Rich brothers, they say, this case has gone far enough. This case has gone too far. This case has gone further than that. So I think that,
well,
now I get it.
That explains it all.
No, but that's hanging the lantern. Like, hey, we're up the creek without a paddle and we're just going to, own that type thing. So,
right. And I mean, as I was saying, I think that maybe that's part of the point, that as we're parsing through all this, like, you're not meant to. The joke is it doesn't make sense because these movies don't make sense. And these explanations are always convoluted and don't actually tell you anything.
Dave, you got any more Ritz Brother quotes?
Oh, I actually wrote, not Ritz Brothers, but Kitty, another character, which hopefully you guys want to talk about a little bit, because she just mugs her way through this whole damn movie, and I love her.
Oh, Kitty the maid?
Yeah, the maid. Yeah. Patsy Kelly is the actress who plays
Okay,
Kitty.
You love her. I'm going to say, might be the worst performance we've ever seen in any film on Awesome Movie.
Probably. But yeah, the butler tells her, I wouldn't be frightened like that if I were you. And she says, well, you be frightened any way you want. This is my way. And bad.
You be frightened any way you want. This is my way. She was
Jimmy
very
Stewart.
I don't know. She was very bad. And all the reviews I've read of this film pointed out how just like, what a scene eater she was.
Total scene eater, yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I feel like she's doing is, like, first of all, she was also an established, like, comedy star in silent films and stuff like that. Worked with Hal Roach, who we mentioned in some episode recently. But she's just matching the energy of the Ritz brothers. Mm-hmm. She's like, you are not going to upstage me, Ritz brothers. I am here, and I am going to get some laughs, too.
I disagree. She's first of all, she doesn't come off as natural as the Rich brothers do.
I don't think natural is a word.
Well, maybe she comes off more efforted, I'd say.
Okay.
You know, and then also if everyone's playing at that level, then no one's playing at that level.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have, like I was saying, the other supporting characters, you know, Lionel Atwill is the old guy who owns the mansion, and his, what is her, his niece, I guess, who shows up,
yeah,
and her fiance, and they're playing it, and I'm sure this was, you know, what they were directed to do, is they're playing it as if they're in one of these regular old Dark House movies.
Yeah, that's the way it should be done, I think.
Right.
You know?
But you're saying that the maid should have also played it that way.
I look at it like, I mean, when I watch Step Brothers now, which I love that movie, right? And you got John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell going balls to the wall. Part of the reason that movie works so well is because Richard Jenkins and Mary Steenburgen are playing it so straight, and they've grounded everything. So there's a foundation for the two comics to go crazy. But if those guys were playing it the same way, then it wouldn't work at all.
But I would say this woman is the Catherine Hahn of that movie.
Right, but she's no Catherine Hahn.
Sure.
Patsy Kelly said this was her favorite performance that she ever gave.
Wow. Interesting. That's nice. Yeah. So, and I think she won a Tony for this film. Yeah, she won a Tony for the revival of No No Nanette, Josh.
Yeah, that was like 30 years later. Yeah. So maybe she toned it down in that intervening time. I thought like when she first showed up, and I think she shows up before even the Ritz brothers do. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, she's kind of funny. Like, maybe she's going to be the, like, wisecracking dame of this film. But no, she's Scooby-Doo, right? She's just, if she could have that, what is that little sound effect that Scooby and Shaggy get when they're trying to
Zoinks!
Run away?
Zoinks!
With the feet yeah, effect. People know what I'm talking about. If they could have added this to this movie, that would have happened, like, every time the maid showed up on screen.
She just didn't do it for me. I think, to go back to your pick, Josh, when we got to the ranch in The Women, and you have that kind of big character who's the ranch hand, other than her just accepting domestic abuse, like she was a bigger character that worked for me. And this one, I just think is so misguided, this performance.
Yeah. I mean, definitely as the movie went on, I was like, okay, this is a far too much of this, and every time she's just gonna like barrel into a scene and screech something and then barrel right out again or whatever.
The other supporting players were fine though. I thought they did a good job.
Yeah, they were fine. I mean, again, they're just kind of playing it straight, and they're meant to almost like fade into the background so that the Ritz brothers can get their spotlight.
They're setting up for they're setting up the spikes, and the Ritz brothers are spiking it down volleyball champ style.
How about Bella showing up out of nowhere?
Oh, right. We didn't even get to Bela Lugosi,
yeah,
who plays the butler here. And he, I think they're playing a little off of his image, right? His horror image, because they suspect him of being the gorilla. Or no, really, it's really like,
I mean,
prejudiced or bigoted or how, you know, whatever we kind of call it, just because he's like Eastern European, they're like, oh, he's spooky. He's got to be the killer.
I think it's partially the personality and partially it's like, he would go and put a blanket on someone and hold his hands out like he's going to choke him. But he's good. I mean, this is a good year for Bela Lugosi. And I'm glad that we're talking about it because we've only talked about him with the Ed Wood movies. And like, it's nice to see. I think he did a good job in this movie.
Yeah, he did. And he seems like he's having fun with it. And maybe he's got that balance where he's not just playing it deadly straight like some of those other supporting players, but he's not constantly mugging the way that Patsy Kelly is. And so he gets to be a little playful, but also, you know, mostly kind of, again, be a comic foil or whatever for the Ritzes.
Right. And at this point in his career, it seemed like it was already on the downturn. But I think this was a really good comeback year for him.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. The other thing, too, here, the director, we should mention, Alan Dwan, who is this like very prolific journeyman director who worked in like every genre that there was. And he doesn't really... Like, you don't want this movie to be visually striking in a way that distracts from the Ritz Brothers comedy. But I feel like those old Dark House movies, the horror movies you directed by people like James Whale, they have this very ornate gothic style. And this movie looks like it takes place in a carnival attraction or whatever. It's very flimsy and basic in terms of that.
I wonder if part of that is the budget. Also, you know, we have the single setting and the house there's good spacing in the house for a, you know, kind of topsy-turvy piece like this. But, you know, how much can you do with that type of budget?
Yeah. I will say that the lighthouse in the octopus is more creative in its visual presentation, but yeah, the plot there makes less sense. The big reveal at the end, or not the big reveal at the end, is that it's all a dream. But before that, every character reveals who seemed to be like a maid or a lighthouse keeper or a ship captain or whatever. They all reveal that they're secretly undercover cops working for various different agencies.
Nice.
Hell yeah. So,
this is amazing. This is a Hollywood at its best in the old days in the American dream. I got this. Dwan started his directing career by accident in 1911 when he was sent by his employers to California in order to locate a company that had vanished. Dwan managed to track the company down and learn that they were waiting for the film's director, who was an alcoholic, to return from a binge and allowing them to return from work. Dwan wired back to his employers in Chicago, informing them of the situation and suggested that they disband the company. They wired back instructing Dwan to direct the film. When Dwan informed the company of the situation and that their jobs were on the line, they responded, "You're the best damn director we ever saw."
I feel like director is on an alcohol binge and unavailable, and replacement is brought in who is a corporate executive, is a situation that could occur today.
The very Coen brothers type setup there or something, you know, for an old Hollywood movie there. But like you said, I mean, he directed Mary Pickford. He directed Douglas Fairbanks. This guy's done a lot of stuff. He helped launch Victor Fleming's career.
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely one of these kind of workhorse guys, and he's not known as an auteur. And, you know, I think that origin speaks to it. The origin of his whole career is that he was a businessman who just was, you know, put in a position of sort of like finishing a job. And that's maybe how he approached filmmaking, as a job. And that's fine. But it's definitely workmanlike. There's no visual creativity or directorial stamp on this film at all.
Okay. So here's the question. I mean, I think of something like Knives Out, and I like the first one better than Glass Onion. Do you guys have a favorite in this kind of comedy, whodunit, caper, everyone's a suspect, we don't know what's happening, possible single setting genre?
I mean, I like Knives Out too, and I'm sure there's some others that I like that I can't think of offhand. I mean, the other thing I thought of when I was watching this was Clue, which I've actually not seen, but yeah. I've just seen enough clips to know.
Clue's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Dave, I mean, this seems like your kind of thing, right? Do you have any other examples of this?
It does, but I'm kind of drawing a blank on other examples. I do think that this reminds me so much of Scooby-Doo, which we've already mentioned, and yeah. It, you know, it feels like a live-action Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, it really does.
Which they made, Dave.
They did. Got its own tone to it, but you know.
Maybe Matthew Lillard and Freddie Prinze Jr. would be the new Ritz Brother replacements if we rewatch this film.
That I think 20 years ago you were right, but not right now. Maybe so.
No, this is their comeback. So I think we've kind of exhausted ourselves. But Dave, did you want to add any last words about to sell people on this?
I mean, I wrote down like a dozen other moments that I loved in this. I'm not going to go through them though. I'll just say. The only other thing, you guys kind of touched on it a little bit, but like, how the hell does this play work? Like, I just don't understand how this could be a play.
I mean, I think, like I said, there's the idea of the play within the play is the sort of plot of it. And I'm sure they've made other alterations to the plot. But my guess is that it's the kind of thing where they created an elaborate set with a bunch of false doors and whatever that was probably cool for people to see on stage. And maybe you came to watch this play as much for that as you did for the actual content. I'm just speculating about that. But I mean, it's a single location thing. And right, one of the big things in this movie is someone sits in a chair, they turn out the lights, and then they're gone. Right? That is an easy effect to put forth on stage. You turn out the lights and the actor walks off stage and then you turn the lights back on.
Yeah, I'd watch it.
Yeah, of course. Of course. You would. So do you want to rate this out of 5 gorillas?
I think we have to. But which gorilla are we rating it out of, Josh?
I don't care.
I gave it 2.5. I was with it. And then, like I said, the end just went nutsy cuckoo. Just so if you demoted it, that would be fine. But Josh, unlike other movies, they did not hurt any gorillas in this one, as 1939, herding a lot of animals, so it keeps its half star for me.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No actual real animal gorillas are in this film. I give it 2 out of 5. I mean, I didn't like it, but I'm glad I saw it because the whole Ritz Brothers thing is a historical, like, Hollywood curiosity that I was not familiar with. So always good to learn about that. Dave, how would you rate this movie?
I'm going to 4, guys.
Yes.
I had so much fun with this. Yes. I was almost going to go down to 3.5, but I had so much fun during this conversation. I was like, nah, it's keeping its 4.
I love that. So, Dave, what movie's better, this or Fool's Paradise?
That's a tough one. I got to go Fool's Paradise. I do absolutely love that movie. But yeah, this is that kind of stupid.
No, this is better than that movie.
All right. We'll come back and talk about the legacy of the gorilla. Welcome back to Awesome Movie Year. In this episode of our season on the films of 1939, we are talking about our producer David Rosen's pick, The Gorilla. And we've talked a bunch already about the Ritz Brothers and their kind of career arc. They were a big vaudeville and nightclub success, and this was part of the effort to make them movie stars. And that effort continued a little while longer. Their final movie together on screen was in 1943, Never a Dull Moment. And after that, they kind of gave up on their Hollywood efforts and returned to their nightclub act. And I guess they were a big act here
big
in
success,
Las Vegas.
Big success, man. Big
yeah,
success.
I mean, but you know, we live here in Vegas, and you know, Jason, you and I have written a lot about Vegas entertainment over the years, and I also had never heard of them as, like, you know, a classic Vegas act along the lines of, you know, the Rat Pack or something like that. Had you, Jason?
No, but I feel like this type of, you know, kind of old school slapstick vaudeville type show could still work today because no one's doing it out here, right? So if you set that up and with the right expectations, I think it could still work.
Jason, your Ritz Brothers tribute act is going to be opening on the strip.
That one I'll actually show up to, Jason.
Oh, Dave, tell me about the three amigos right there, the three musketeers with the Ritz Brothers.
Yeah, it's really fun. I mean, the three of them, they're. It starts out, if you look at Letterboxd, you'll see anybody who's actually watched that movie talking about the soup song, which is really funny and really well done. But they kind of take the place of, you know, the Musketeers, and then they're just doing their usual stuff. They do feel a lot like they do here, except for they're Musketeers instead of being detectives. But they just start bouncing off of each other and completely, you know, inept in doing
musketeering.
Musketeering, yes, exactly. But like I said on my Letterboxd review, it's definitely, like, broader, and I could see more people actually enjoying that one than the gorilla. It's not as, like, weird. It's very Three Stoogey if they were in the Three Musketeers.
Yeah, that I feel like that, again, is something where we insert these comedians into some classic public domain material and then see what happens.
Yeah.
So Al Ritz died in 1965, and Harry and Jimmy Ritz continued on a bit on their own. They show up in a couple 1970s, like, lowbrow comedies, both of which seem like movies Dave would want to watch.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Blazing Stewardesses from, I think it's Al Adamson, who's a famous, like, softcore director, and Wonton Ton, the dog who saved Hollywood. Dave, have you seen that?
I literally put it on my watch list after I finished the other two movies, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. Made TV appearances on game shows. And Harry Ritz, speaking of Mel Brooks, shows up in Mel Brooks's silent movie. And I assume you've seen that, Jason.
Actually, that's still, like, I think the only Mel Brooks movie I haven't seen at this point in time.
Ah, well, if you do watch it, keep your eye out for Harry Ritz in that film. So, yeah, the Ritzes, the other two Ritzes, both lived into the 1980s and I guess are beloved by some people.
They were managed by their brother George. They were in animated cartoons from Warner Brothers and Walt Disney. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, sure.
Josh, you're not a Ritz guy, but everyone else is. So.
No. Alan Dwan, as we said, was an incredibly prolific director whose career started in the 1910s, and he continued working into the 1960s in, again, all sorts of genres. I think his most famous film, I was kind of looking through this, is probably The Sands of Iwo Jima, which is a John Wayne war movie, but also he directed Heidi and Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, which
I thought those were more famous, but what do I know?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe so. I mean, those certainly are. I feel like the John Wayne one is pretty well known, but again, a lot of different ones. He did a version of Robin Hood. And I was looking, this guy is such a sort of chameleon. I thought, oh, have I seen an Alan Dwan film? And yeah, I've seen 5 Alan Dwan films, including this, in random genres. Westerns, The River's Edge and Tennessee's Partner, and this kind of weird Technicolor noir movie called Slightly Scarlet. And he actually had a little profile collection on the Criterion Channel a few months ago. So maybe being rediscovered as an auteur in some way.
All right. Let's get our films on and learn more about this gentleman here, Josh. Let's get our Dwan going, Josh.
yes, indeed. So Patsy Kelly, as we were talking about, she had been teamed with Thelma Todd in a bunch of short comedies in early Hollywood. And I, you know, as much as she is annoying in this film, I was impressed. Her film career in the 1930s was kind of sidelined because she came out openly as a lesbian in the 1930s. And that's got to be a difficult thing to do and, you know, be bold enough to do that.
Yeah, good for her, man. I hope people treated her well. We'll never know.
But, no, they didn't. Well,
sadly. wasn't she also Tallulah Bankhead's assistant?
And lover.
Oh, my God. She won at life.
Yes. So, yes, she was. I mean, as her roles dried up, it seems like after she came out, she worked for Tallulah Bankhead and worked for Tallulah Bankhead and then did eventually get back into working on stage and in TV. And Jason, as you said, she won a Tony in 1971 and yet cited this film as her favorite performance of hers.
Good for her, Josh. Hell good yeah. for She's her. Cool. Lionel Atwell is all over the movies in this decade, Josh. And I think he's also in the next movie we're covering, Son of Frankenstein, right there. So that's exciting.
Yeah, both him and Bela Lugosi, of course, I think we'll talk more about them and their work in Universal horror movies. And we did do an episode on Glenn or Glenda, the Ed Wood film in our 1953 season, and talk a bit about the sad later career of Bela Lugosi. But this was when he was really a star of all these horror movies and was super famous for that.
And I mean, steals the show in Son of Frankenstein, I think.
Oh, he yeah. does. He does indeed. So, yeah, I was looking to see if maybe this play has ever been revived. No, it has not.
It should and be, Josh.
Weirdly, right, it was adapted into 4 movies between 1927 and 1939. Never again.
Now's the time, Dave. Now's the time.
I think it's the three of us, really.
Yeah, that's it. Awesome movie year starring in The Gorilla.
Hell yeah.
Josh, which Ritz brother are you going to play?
Is there a silent one? Is there is it Harpo or Zeppo, whichever the silent Marx brother is? Is there one of those? I'll be that one.
I think we could do that. So it's interesting to me, Anita Louise, Josh, who is, you know, like you said, the niece playing straight here. I mean, she was in A Midsummer Night's Dream. She was in Marie Antoinette, The Story of Louis Pasteur, so the Little Princess. This seems like a departure in style for her.
Yeah, well, I think at this point she was taking whatever work she could get, probably. And sometimes you got to star in The Gorilla or co-star in The Gorilla.
Lyle Talbot was the neighbor on Ozzie and Harriet, founding member of SAG, and Joseph Kalila, who was the stranger, Josh. He played the stranger in this movie. Do you remember The Stranger, Josh? He was the stranger in this movie.
I don't. Wait, who was Lyle Talbot in this film?
I don't know. Leave me alone. Maybe I missed. I got nothing. So let's just go.
I think we're good here on this. So that is The Gorilla. And that is this episode of Awesome Movie Year. You can reach your gorilla arm out to us online and on social media.
We're at awesomemovieyear.com, Awesome Movie Year on Facebook and Instagram, Awesome Movie Pod on Dead in the Dirt.
It's still going. It's an undead social media platform, really.
It's a Frankenstein. I'm Jason Harris Comedy or Jay Harris Comedy on all the things. And yeah, go find me on Letterboxd. Go for Jason.
I am at Signal Bleed on that dead site or whatever on Twitter, as well as at Signal Bleed on Blue Sky and on Letterboxd. I am at Josh Bell Hates Everything on Facebook, and you can find some old stuff from me at joshbellhateseverything.com. And if you're on Letterboxd and you review The Gorilla or any other movie that we talk about, tag your reviews with Awesome Movie Year. We love to hear what people are saying about our films, and we're going to make this happen. So that, and listen to our producer David Rosen's awesome podcast, Piecing It Together.
Check out Piecing It Together wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow us on social media at Piecing Pod, and yeah, you can follow me on Letterboxd at By David Rosen, and give my The Gorilla 4-star rating a like.
Yeah,
Jason, we kind of went through it.
Son of Frankenstein.
What's in our next episode?
Son of Frankenstein.
It is our cult classic pick, Son of Frankenstein. So tune in next time for that. And thanks for listening to Awesome Movie Year.
Thank you for listening to Awesome Movie Year. Make sure to follow Awesome Movie Year on Facebook, at Awesome Movie Pod on Twitter, and at Awesome Movie Year on Instagram. And if you like the show, review us and rate us with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
An All Points West production, produced by David Rosen in Las Vegas.
This is the best episode we've ever done.
Yeah. You're really enjoying those sound effects there, Jason. I'm imagining you having like some notes in front of you that just say like blah, 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 blah.
That's hilarious.
The list of little like a comic book sound effect noise or whatever you've got there.
I gotta text my neighbor to come over and throw that pie in my face now.
There were no pies in faces here. No one got sprayed with seltzer, right? I mean, these are classics.
Yeah.